I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. As a private citizen and presidential candidate, Donald Trump said the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan, calling the war a complete waste, a total disaster, and complaining the billion should be spent on rebuilding this country, not that one. Last night, he acknowledged that the world looks different from behind the desk in the Oval Office. He addressed the nation from Fort Myer about his plan for victory in America's longest war, saying the U.S. is not nation building, we are killing terrorists, and the new approach will be based on conditions, not on timetables. While it was short on specifics, President Trump rejected a rapid exit and said we would fight to win.
Our troops will fight to win. We will fight to win. From now on, victory will have a clear definition. Attacking our enemies, obliterating ISIS, crushing Al-Qaeda, preventing the Taliban from taking over Afghanistan, and stopping mass terror attacks against America before they emerge.
He told Pakistan to stop providing safe haven for the Taliban and other terrorist groups.
We have been paying Pakistan billions and billions of dollars at the same time they are housing the very terrorists that we are fighting. But that will have to change, and that will change immediately. No partnership can survive a country's harboring of militants and terrorists who target U.S. service members and officials. It is time for Pakistan to demonstrate its commitment to civilization, order, and to peace.
Today on Radio Times, we discuss America's longest war, how we can end it, and if a win is even possible. Joining us is Dan DeLuce. He's chief national security correspondent for Foreign Policy, joining us from their ISDN studios. And Dan DeLuce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Michael Kugelman is with us as well, Asia Program Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Michael Kugelman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Good to be here with you.
Nice to have you with us. Dan, let me begin with you listening to those couple of sound clips and also watching the president last night. Is there a Trump doctrine as it is applied to Afghanistan? And is it any different from what President Obama did?
I don't think there's a, you can say there's a doctrine here emerging at all. Some people are trying to say that. I think it's pretty hard to make that argument. And really, if you did put another president's name to that speech last night, in many ways, what's really going to happen, a very modest increase in the number of troops on the ground, a sort of open-ended commitment. You could definitely imagine Hillary Clinton as president sort of supporting some plan that looked a lot like that. You can even imagine President Obama talking about a plan like that. I think the one thing that comes through is you know, he said there's no deadline, there's no timeline, there's no date certain where the U.S. is going to exit. And Obama was criticized sharply for kind of setting very explicitly and publicly a date to exit, to withdraw troops. And he got a lot of heat for that also from the military, which opposed that approach. But it's still not clear what the strategy is here. What is the U.S. really trying to accomplish? He said in his speech he wanted to prevent the Taliban from taking over the country, from taking power again. But it's not clear beyond that what success or quote-unquote winning looks like.
Well, I want to get back to all of that. To you, Michael Kugelman, I thought it was interesting the critical words that the president had for Pakistan. What's the message to Pakistan coming from this administration?
Well, the message is one that we've heard before. Again, there's really nothing new here. President Trump has basically said that Pakistan needs to stop working with terrorist groups that threaten and attack Americans in Afghanistan. And he essentially called on Pakistan to eliminate the sanctuaries that it has long provided on its soil for the Afghan Taliban and for its Haqqani network partners. Again, we've heard this so many times before. Previous U.S. leaders have gotten into this, and you know, at the end of the day, does anything change? Does anything happen? Does Pakistan change its ways? And the answer is no. And you know, as was noted, we didn't really hear many specifics on anything with this speech, and you know, that includes the Pakistan angle. What exactly does Trump plan to do that his predecessors have not done that would get Pakistan to eliminate these sanctuaries? And it could involve something like conditioning future military aid on Pakistan taking more robust action. That's been tried in the past and hasn't worked. So I think in Islamabad, the main response to Trump's comments on Pakistan were basically to, you know, roll their eyes and said, oh, here we go again. We've heard this before. I don't really think people are that worried or concerned there.
Why does Pakistan, though, have these safe havens for terrorists and others to hide in and then to launch attacks in Afghanistan from?
Well, in my view, it all comes down to India. I mean, as you know, Pakistan and India are enemies that have fought multiple wars, and Pakistan views India as an existential threat. And Pakistan worries about India deepening its already strong relations with Afghanistan. India has a pretty significant presence in Afghanistan through its development assistance and economic support. It recently financed a new parliament building in Kabul. It supported the construction of a dam there. Pakistan worries that India uses Afghan territory as a base from which to orchestrate or support acts of meddling or sabotage inside Pakistan, which includes, according to Pakistan, Indian efforts to provide support to separatist rebels in the Balochistan province of Pakistan. So the main reason why Pakistan maintains these ties to groups like the Taliban and the Haqqani Network is that it sees them as useful assets to push back against the presence of India and Afghanistan, because these groups, the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, certainly they attack Afghans, they attack Americans and their NATO partners, but they also attack Indians. There have been attacks on Indian consulates in Afghanistan in the past. And my own view is that this is a deeply held strategic interest on the part of Pakistan. And it is not going to be in a position where it would want to eliminate those sanctuaries and sever its ties with the Taliban just because President Trump or any other U.S. leader, for that matter, is asking it or demanding it to do so.
Dan, I do want to get back to you, but to you, Michael, he seemed to be saying last night, India good, Pakistan not so good. Does that just exacerbate the conflicts between those two countries?
It does. And again, there's nothing new here because the Obama administration, particularly in its last 2 years, was going in that direction. The Obama White House really was pushing for a deepening what has become known as a strategic partnership between the U.S. and India. Whereas with Pakistan, there had been initial efforts during the early years of the Obama administration to actually develop a strategic partnership with Pakistan as well. But that didn't work out, and the last few years of the Obama administration were characterized by a U.S.-Pakistan relationship that was really starting to drift apart. And so in that sense, you know, what Trump was articulating last night about India and about Pakistan very much reflects what the direction that the Obama administration had been going in as well.
Dan, the president did not say last night specifically the numbers of troops, American troops, that would be going to Afghanistan. I read this morning we're talking about the possibility of 4,000 troops. Is that, if there's a changed policy or if we're adding troops to Afghanistan, is that the number we should think about?
Yes, that's the number that's out there, and that's the number officials are talking about privately and have done for some time. And that's in the scheme of things, especially if you look at U.S. military missions, that is not an overwhelming number, obviously. It doesn't necessarily transform the situation on the ground. I think what's interesting here is how long it took the president to come to this decision. This whole approach and plan was presented to him months ago, dating back to May, if not before that. And what's interesting is how reluctant and ambivalent he was about doing this, which he did refer to in the speech. And you had him flirting with all sorts of other ideas. You had him talking with Eric Prince, the very controversial founder of the Blackwater private security firm. And Prince was openly pushing this idea of basically turning the war over to private security contractors.
With him as viceroy, as I understand it.
With someone as viceroy, yes.
Yes.
And possibly Prince somehow directly or indirectly profiting, although he might disagree with that. So that was quite a radical idea. Again, very controversial. In the end, all of that faded away, and he and the president came around to a quite a conventional kind of status quo kind of decision. And it was interesting. He really squirmed during this process. And then critics will say that many months have passed now, and a certain amount of U.S. credibility might have been damaged, too. And it made allies very nervous that he was kind of all over the place and contemplating some of these ideas. I think there's another thing that comes through here. You can see it coming through in our conversation, and that is that the U.S. has sort of run out of ideas here. This flummoxed previous administrations, dating back to the Bush administration. There's no easy solutions, and I think Trump was looking for a silver bullet, and it just isn't there. And his advisors and most of his cabinet was telling him, you know, we've just got to stay the course. We've got to you know, be patient. And this is a president not known for his patience. So I think this was very difficult for the president to come around to this. And as Michael points out, what is the leverage the U.S. has on Pakistan? Not clear.
Yeah, what is the leverage? Let me just follow up on something quickly. I think there's something like 8,400 American troops currently stationed in Afghanistan, many of them working with the Afghanistan military. Dan, there are many more contractors. They may not be working for Eric Prince, but many more contractors in Afghanistan, and we don't ever talk about them.
Yes, and they're there, and they are not in the lead role, performing combat duties. You know, you still have special operations forces that will go after Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, and you have them. You have U.S. forces in uniform advising and assisting the Afghan forces on the ground. But yes, there are contractors. Thousands of them, because that's what the U.S. does now. They rely on them to help out with logistics. There are these air bases that we have there, the U.S. uses, and its allies. They've got to maintain all these aircraft. And, of course, keep in mind the Afghan military is still not able to stand on its own at all. And it relies heavily on the U.S. For its logistics, for air power. There's a tiny little Afghan Air Force, but in the end, when you need an airstrike to help out in a situation, the U.S. has to come and deliver that. So there's a lot of logistics and maintenance there.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dan DeLuce. He's Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy. Also with us, Michael Kugelman. He's Asia Program Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. We are talking about President Trump's speech last night, talking about the way forward, as he would describe it, for the war in Afghanistan. Of course, America's longest war. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think the U.S. should do? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Michael Kugelman and Dan DeLuce about America's longest war, perhaps our forgotten war as well. Michael, if I can go back to you, and even going back to the speech from the president last night talking about Pakistan, he says we can no longer be silent about Pakistan's safe havens for terrorist organizations, the Taliban, and other groups that pose a threat to the region and beyond. We were talking about the limited options that the U.S. has, but what kind of pressure could the Trump administration put on Pakistan to shut them down or to reduce their ability to wage war against Americans and Afghanistan people in the country of Afghanistan? Is it a matter of reducing aid or sanctions or even things like airstrikes? Is that on the table?
Yeah, well, I think since the Trump administration has telegraphed a desire to take a harder line against Pakistan, we can assume that some of those options are on the table. As I said earlier, the idea of conditioning aid on the need for Pakistan to do more about these terror groups may not be effective just because it's been tried in the past and hasn't worked. You know, one option is for the Trump administration to expand the drone war by going after some of these Taliban leaders in the province of Balochistan. Now, as you'll recall, last year, the Obama administration actually went after Mullah Mansour, then head of the Afghan Taliban in Balochistan, and killed him. And that was seen as a one-off thing. Right. Now, what if the Trump administration were to try to, you know, take that lead and try to stage additional drone strikes there? The Pakistani intelligence and military establishment has offered tacit support in the past to drone strikes that happen in Pakistan, but only those that have happened where the majority of strikes have occurred, and that's in the tribal areas, not in the settled areas, including Balochistan. Now, it would be very difficult for the U.S. to do those types of drone strikes, in my view, without some level of cooperation with Pakistan, as it would need some level of intelligence support. So maybe that could be a way to put pressure on the Pakistanis. And then there are other options, too, such as actually placing sanctions on Pakistani military leaders and making it difficult for them to travel. And then there's certain legislation that could be looked at, like declaring Pakistan as a state sponsor of terror, or something that would be a bit less hardline, and that would be to revoke the non-NATO ally status that the U.S. had given to Pakistan. But at the end of the day, I go back to what I said before. If the U.S. does any of these things, would that really lead Pakistan to change its ways? Or, more likely, would it simply double down on the policies that it's been using? Because for Pakistan, the preeminent paramount factor in any of its considerations about security or militancy or foreign policy is India. And it sees, unfortunately, it sees these militant groups as useful assets to push back against this threat that it views is, that it believes is posed by India. Of course, Pakistan has a right to have its own strategic interests. And if it's not going to alter them, despite incessant pressure from the U.S., then obviously that's its right, as unpalatable as that may seem to us.
Such a complicated part of the world. Here's a comment from Ed. I'll put this to you, Dan. He says Afghanistan might have natural resources that we've been interested in since George Herbert Walker Bush's administration. And I know there are mineral deposits in Afghanistan. How much do you think that's a factor in our policy?
That's a really good question. You know, this is also something that has come up in the past and been talked about. It's sort of a tantalizing idea, right, that's, that somehow this very impoverished, troubled country can be kind of lifted out of its darkness by riches under the earth. There is tremendous mineral wealth there, you know, copper, iron, there are rare earth minerals that are needed for tech products we all use. But to get at those, you have to have a reasonable amount of security and peace so that companies can extract it. You've got to have infrastructure to move it out on roads and so on. All that's lacking. And then, it is a good question. General Petraeus, who used to be the commander, you know, about 7 years ago, he saw this as this tremendous opportunity, and he cited some Pentagon study that estimated the wealth there, you know, around a massive $1 trillion.
Wow.
And of course, commodity prices have since gone down, so
that's a lot of money.
But that is a lot of money. And what is interesting, and we wrote about this in Foreign Policy, is the president. The current president became very interested in this, and he met with a chemical mineral executive named Michael Silver, and Silver was making the case to him, you know, there is tremendous wealth there, and the U.S. needs to get in on this or we'll lose out. So having spent all this blood and treasure, we don't want to lose out to China. And you can imagine how that made an impression on the president. So this, I would watch that issue. I think this administration is interested in this, and the president has tasked Wilbur Ross, the head of the Commerce Department, to assess the whole sector and what's possible there. So I would watch that. That's a good question.
Let me put something back to you, Michael. I was reading in, I guess it was the Times this morning, that Russia also is involved in this region of the world, apparently has been talking with the Taliban and maybe even providing material support. I mean, talk about a complicated neighborhood. What role do you see Russia playing?
Yeah, right, exactly. Russia, we talked about China. We could also talk about Iran. I think with Russia, there are several factors at play. One is that Russia is a revisionist power, and it seeks to undercut U.S. influence in the world and U.S. clout in the world. And so these reports that we've been hearing, including from top U.S. military officials, that Russia has actually sought to provide support, including arms, to the Taliban, you know, that starts to come into play. What better way to undercut the U.S. than to try to provide some support to the chief U.S. non-state nemesis in the region and in Afghanistan, the Taliban? The other factor here is something that we haven't really gotten into yet, and that is ISIS, which has a presence in Afghanistan. It's been there for several years, and Russia worries about ISIS, as it should. I mean, this is a group that now has a presence on Russia's doorstep. And so I think Russia feels, perhaps, that it could try to neutralize or at least reduce the threat of ISIS in Afghanistan by providing some semblance of support to the Taliban, which is a rival of ISIS. And they may be cut from the same ideological cloth. The Taliban is a rival of ISIS, and that's because the Taliban is very closely aligned with al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda, of course, is a rival of ISIS right now. And at the same time, you know, if things were different, if U.S.-Russia relations were better, Russia actually has similar interests in Afghanistan to what the U.S. does. And Russia worries about destabilization in Afghanistan. It worries about the impact that could have in terms of refugee flows, drug trade. You know, that would have deleterious implications for Russia. So, you know, if the politics were better between the U.S. and Russia, there could actually be grounds for cooperation. And one could say the same thing about Iran, for that matter. But obviously, it's not an ideal world.
Boy, is that an understatement. That's Michael Kugelman, Asia Program Deputy Director, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Dan DeLuce with us as well, and he's Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy. We are talking about America's war in Afghanistan, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Marla Keenan to join us. She is Managing Director at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, and that's at the Truman National Security Project. We want to talk with her about civilian casualties in Afghanistan, how American forces can reduce them. Marla Keenan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to clarify, I'm actually the Senior Director of Programs at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, and I'm a National Security Fellow at Truman.
Okay, sorry about that.
No,
we will try to fix that. Well, we're happy to have you join our conversation.
You.
Such an important part of this discussion. Do we know how many civilians have died in the 16-year war?
Yeah, I mean it's been thousands of civilians, and you know there's a great organization that records civilian casualties called the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. And I would just note one thing is that there's been actually a 70% increase just in the first 6 months of 2017 in comparison to 2016.
Why?
Well, it's hard to tell. Again, when we have policies in place where we're not clear what the strategy is, it's difficult to know. I mean, certainly with a drawdown of U.S. troops and of ISAF troops, we're seeing airstrikes that are killing civilians, and part of that can be possibly because they don't have the right mechanisms in place. The lessons that were identified in Afghanistan when we had major combat operations there seem to have been falling away recently.
Is that what happens when you go from one administration to the next, one presidential administration in this country to the next, is that you're going to have different policy, different leaders talking to each other?
It's possible. It's also possible that as, you know, troops do their regular rotations, there are a smaller amount of troops there. Troops are rotating in and out more often. And so that sort of long lens and that information that you gather over many years doesn't seem to be sticking as a lesson learned. You know, it's been identified. Many of the generals have noted that civilian harm in Afghanistan was one of the key things that harmed U.S. Strategy there. But it doesn't seem that we're still sort of on the same level of trying to avoid that civilian harm that we were in previous years.
Do we know how many civilians have died because of Taliban, al-Qaeda, ISIS?
Yeah, it's of course difficult to know. There are various different entities that do recording of these things. I mean, UNAMA's numbers, I would say, probably give us the best indication. But again, it's very difficult to know. Some of these things are happening in very remote areas. Civilians are, you know, living in areas where it's very difficult to report. the harm, and therefore it's very difficult to get real numbers on this.
Let me go back to what the president said last night, and he said micromanaging from Washington, D.C. does not win battles. They're won in the field, drawing upon the judgment and expertise of wartime commanders and frontline soldiers, acting in real time with real authority and with a real clear mission to defeat the enemy. It's sort of unclear how that gets translated into actual strategy, but as you understand the policy such as it is this morning, Marla, what do you think this new surge, small surge of U.S. troops into Afghanistan, what do you think that will mean for civilians? Do we have any way of knowing?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly difficult to tell based on what we heard last night. I think President Trump rightly points out that it's been America's longest war, but it's also been a long and incredibly costly war for Afghan people. And so understanding how the U.S. government, but also how the U.S. military is going to go about their stated interest to, quote-unquote, kill terrorists is very important, because killing terrorists really is just an activity along a process to get to a strategy. It's not a strategy in itself, because to ignore the sort of second and third order effects that might happen, including civilian harm, when you are, quote-unquote, killing terrorists, really puts you a little bit behind what we would call for in terms of strategic thinking about what the actual ultimate and long-term impact is.
Dave, let me go back to you, and let's assume that these 4,000 additional troops will be there to largely help the Afghan military take on the Taliban and other terrorist organizations. Why has that been such a difficult thing to do?
Well, I mean, the most of the troops on the ground and the troops that will be coming will not be going after, sort of the small number of al-Qaeda or Islamic State extremists there. They'll be actually alongside and advising and helping Afghan forces fight the Taliban. It's always been this really difficult fight. Fighting an insurgency in a foreign country is notoriously difficult, and success is elusive throughout history. You have a situation where the U.S. is no longer sort of occupying the country with 100,000-plus troops. It's a much smaller footprint. The U.S. comes in with air power, sort of logistical help, advice, where they work with the Afghan forces. But Al-Qaeda there's a relatively small number, but they're there, and they're impossible to sort of completely take out. I would like to go back to the civilian casualty issue.
Sure, go ahead.
I think that has been a constant problem, obviously, and it was something that commanders have spoken of over the years. The UN says about two-thirds of the civilian casualties are due to the Taliban and other extremist groups. But that still means that when the U.S. or allied forces drop bombs, that civilians get killed. And one of the ways that that can happen more often than it did in the past is if you give the military on the ground a bit more leeway and a bit fewer restrictions and looser rules about how they can use force and when they can use it. When General McChrystal was in charge of the U.S. mission during the surge, during the Obama administration, when there was a peak of U.S. troops there, he tried to restrain and restrict the use of air power and artillery to try to avoid as much as possible the risk of civilian deaths and injury, because he felt that not only was there kind of a moral case, but there was a strategic reason to avoid doing that if you're trying to sort of separate the insurgents and not allow them to gain any kind of popularity or support on the ground. Now that's different.
Yeah. Gloves off, you think? Gloves off?
It is a bit gloves off, and that predates Trump even. There was a request from the previous commander Campbell, who pushed very hard for more authorities, more leeway. And so you now have air power is now used with less restrictions. When the Taliban is massing, when they can see a large number of insurgents, they're able to use air power. And under Trump, the whole kind of culture and climate is that the White House will not be kind of setting limits and restrictions on the military.
Marla, final question to you before we have to say goodbye. So looking ahead, I mean, if the goal is to reduce the number of civilian casualties or something to protect civilians either from the Taliban or from drone strikes or U.S. airstrikes, will that in any way lead for more support for U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
I mean, it's impossible to tell, right? We're 16 years into this, and I certainly can tell you from our research that harming civilians does cause frustration and anger amongst the population.
Sure.
So, you know, the opposite would perhaps be correct as well. But one thing I'll add is that, you know, reducing the emphasis on minimizing civilian harm is not going to hasten this war's end. If anything, it's going to probably lengthen it into the next generation. And, you know, it's a surge in itself doesn't necessarily mean that there will be more civilian harm if, for example, the surge includes additional intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities and ability to train Afghan soldiers or airmen on how to call in airstrikes in a more safe way, ensuring that all of the safeguards that are in place, including those strike lists, are up to date and have all of the important facilities, such as medical facilities and religious facilities, on them. So we need to understand exactly what this surge is doing and who's involved in it, because in the end, it could actually provide additional safety if the correct assets are put in place.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Marla Keenan, thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior Director of Programs at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, a Security Fellow at the Truman National Security Project. Dan DeLuce and Michael Kugelman staying with us for the rest of the hour. Much more to discuss, talking about the war in Afghanistan. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. A lot of comments here. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane reading a tweet that says, "The Afghanistan war is not the forgotten war except by the Democrats who apparently want to forget what brought us to Asia to fight." Talking with Dan DeLuce, Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy, Michael Kugelman, Asia Program Deputy Director, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Michael, let me go back to you. And I read that the Taliban today holds more ground than they did in 2002. I'm assuming that's correct, or some version of being correct. I hear people talking about winning and about victory. How do you define what a satisfactory conclusion to this war would look like? I feel weird asking it that way, because I don't even know what I'm talking about.
No, that's an important question to ask, and there's no easy answer. And I think that one of the things that really stuck out for me from Trump's comments last night was this very strong emphasis on winning and victory.
Right.
But I think the notion of winning the war in Afghanistan is a false one. I do not think that this is a war that can be won in a traditional military sense. I mean, because anything we've learned over the last 16 years of fighting there, there's no way to win this war militarily, because we had, more than 100,000 U.S. troops there at the height of the surge in 2010 and 2011, and that didn't win the war. So if we couldn't win the war at that point with those types of resources, clearly we're not going to be able to do so now, where we'll have probably somewhere around 12,000 U.S. Mm-hmm. troops, even despite some significant progress made by the Afghan security forces in terms of their war-fighting capacities. I think that if we want to look at how to define something closely approximating victory, we have to look at not defeating the Taliban on the battlefield, but rather coming up with some type of political solution, some type of political resolution, a peace process that would basically culminate in the Taliban agreeing to put down its arms, abide by the Afghan constitution, support Afghan democracy, and so forth. The problem is, I don't see that outcome as any more likely than a military solution to the war. And really, for a very simple reason. The Taliban, as you noted, is doing quite well for itself. It is true that it controls more territory now in Afghanistan than it has at any other time since U.S. forces entered in 2001. What a striking and sobering statistic that is.
That forever? Is this? Are we talking forever war then? Or yeah, some version of we have U.S. troops on the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. We have them in Japan. We have them in Germany. Some version of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that we have to worry about now because, you know, for the Taliban to have the incentives to sit down and end the war through negotiation, it just seems so unlikely to me. Why would it step off the battlefield when it's doing so well? So, yes, unfortunately, I think we have to look to the possibility of a really drawn-out war. I would be very surprised if we still had troops in Afghanistan 50 years from now. I hope we don't.
50.
Now, another analogy that we hear, yeah, 50. Another 50. Analogy that we hear is Colombia. You know, there was a long-running insurgency there that took about 50 years or so to end, and then there was finally a negotiated outcome. Again, do we want to be in Afghanistan 50 years from now, 5-0? I don't think so. And I think after a point in time, this becomes a political risk for President Trump, because I would assume that much of his political base does not like the idea of an open-ended, extended military commitment in a far-off place like Afghanistan. So if things don't start changing on the ground in Afghanistan in the next year or two, he may face a difficult decision where he needs to think about if he can really get away politically with this type of extended, open-ended military commitment in Afghanistan.
Dan, I was looking at some articles. The Secretary of State Rex Tillerson apparently opened to some kind of dialogue between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Does that seem like a reasonable option?
Well, certainly, as Michael's pointed out, there is no military solution. There is no way to end this war with military action. And it always seems that even predating this administration, there's been a disproportionate amount of attention paid to tactics, to numbers of troops, to the composition of the U.S. and Western military mission, and not on the elements of a diplomatic strategy, some kind of a very broad, sophisticated diplomatic political plan, bringing in the regional powers, including Iran, including Pakistan, and try to come up with a formula. But it is very difficult. And as Michael pointed out, if you do not have, if one of the parties feels it's winning militarily, then your prospects for success are very limited. The Obama administration did sometimes speak about the idea of piling enough military pressure on the Taliban to sort of convey to them they were not going to be able to win, that it's a stalemate on the battlefield, and that that would force them to the peace talks. But various efforts foundered, but it is certainly an option to go and try to pick up talks again. But you didn't hear the president speaking much about diplomacy last night.
No. I noticed that President Ghani, Ashraf Ghani of Afghanistan, also the Afghanistan ambassador to the U.S., Dan, seemed to be quite happy with what the president said yesterday. Should that surprise us?
No, I think in a way you could simplify all of the president's decision in one way, which was he was basically told by the military and the Pentagon, you have a choice. You can get out and withdraw. And then they listed all the risks and the potential damage from that decision versus you can stay. You can stay and increase the number of troops somewhat. And it seems that the president concluded that the risks of departing were worse, outweighed the risks of staying. And the Afghan government was fearful of any kind of a drawdown or withdrawal. The Afghan government feels that the U.S. needs to stay behind them militarily to convey to the Taliban that the Taliban can't wait out the U.S. and its NATO partners. But the Afghan government has tremendous challenges. There's at root here a problem of legitimacy. It's not clear that many Afghans all have confidence in this government as truly a representative, legitimate government. And this is the root problem.
Is that because of corruption or ineptitude or other complicated things like that?
All of the above. And there are ethnic politics here as well. And a lot of the Pashtun community remains skeptical of Kabul. And yes, corruption's a problem. You didn't have some kind of long tradition of strong, centralized, efficient government there. So all of those are a factor, and Pakistan is a factor, as Michael has described. But in the end, it does seem that there has to be a political and diplomatic endgame that the U.S. has to pursue. It may take years to play out, but it seems that that is the only way out in the end, but it may take many years. And it would be interesting to hear what Secretary Tillerson has to say. But, you know, this is an administration where diplomacy seems to be marginalized most of the time. The State Department's role has been diminished. The president tends to turn to the military and generals and former generals for advice. And so a lot of this discussion was about military resources and not diplomatic strategies. I may be wrong, but it doesn't seem to, you don't hear the White House talking a lot about diplomacy. I'd be interested to hear what Michael would say about
it. Yeah, I would too. And Michael, if I can just add to that, that the State Department either got rid of or is in the process of getting rid of the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. I Googled something, and this is dated June 23rd of this year, but is that a message that we should try to understand?
No, absolutely. And I think there's no better indication of the lack of priority this administration accords to diplomacy in the fact that key top-level positions have not been filled for Afghanistan or for South Asia within the State Department. And, of course, you know, we don't yet have a new ambassador in Afghanistan or India, for that matter. And, you know, if this Trump White House is really serious about supporting some type of political reconciliation with the Taliban, I mean, you need the diplomats running that show. You can't have the Pentagon, you certainly can't have the generals, or you shouldn't have the generals trying to be the ones that run that type of operation. You need diplomats to know how to deal with these types of negotiations and reconciliations and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it is true that overall, diplomacy has been marginalized when it comes to foreign policy in this Trump administration, and certainly in Afghanistan. And, you know, what's very interesting is that after this very long, 8-month strategic review of Afghanistan, in the end, Trump sided with the views of the generals and the ex-generals in his administration. And he had, from the start, from the time he took office as president, had indicated his support for the military and the idea that he would want to defer to a lot of their judgments when it comes to Afghanistan. I think that's exactly what he did in the strategy, as evidenced by the fact that he does seem to have signed off on sending several thousand more troops to Afghanistan and keeping the U.S. there militarily for the foreseeable future.
Dan, do you think it's any coincidence that Steve Bannon was either summarily lost his job or left or was fired on Friday, and Monday night we're hearing about sending troops into Afghanistan?
I don't think it was a coincidence. I think that was very interesting. Obviously, there were other factors. But you had a meeting at Camp David on Friday, last Friday, the day that Bannon's departure was revealed. Bannon was opposed to this decision, and he tried very hard to fight it. And you already see his news site, Breitbart, criticizing this outcome. So you have certain elements of Trump's base are skeptical of sort of long drawn out counterinsurgency campaigns mm-hmm. like this one. And it was interesting, as Michael noted, that the speech had a lot of rhetoric about winning.
Yes.
And usually when you fight an insurgency, you don't have D-Days and unconditional surrender days. You have peace settlements like Colombia. And the military often cites Colombia as a possible model for Afghanistan, despite all the many, many, many differences. So, yes, I think that Bannon lost this argument.
Lost his job. Yes, right.
Yes, but he still has a platform, obviously, and other people who agree with Bannon will possibly come after the White House and come after the president. a year from now or 2 years from now, depending on how this goes, this could be a bit of a political headache, especially talking about winning. You set yourself up that way. It's a bit like putting that banner on the ship saying a mission accomplished in Iraq.
Let me read some comments. A tweet from ATP. Remember when we were warned it was easy to go into Afghanistan, but no one ever found getting out anything but impossible. A comment from Rick. I was a contractor and worked in Bosnia, and the situation under the Dayton Accords with President Clinton. He made a good decision to send contractors who were veterans, who were retirees, and did not have to commit U.S. forces. This was referring to something that we talked about earlier in the hour. A tweet from Paul. On the surface, Afghanistan beneath it to look presidential after pandering to his white supremacist base last week. That's a reference to the president. We have just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. And Michael, if I can go back to you. So what will you be looking for, I guess, in the next couple of months, maybe the next 50 years, as you referenced?
Well, above all, I'll stick to the near term. Those high level positions need to be filled. Above all, now that there's a strategy for Afghanistan, we need an ambassador in Kabul. That's key. We also, even if the State Department is being sidelined, we need to have key officials dealing with South Asia, including Afghanistan there. What I'll be looking at is to see what happens over the next year or so with the Afghan security forces. And I think that, as was mentioned, if we're talking about a modest troop increase into Afghanistan, those troops can be used to help enhance the training mission and in very specific ways. I'll single out one in particular. The special forces in Afghanistan are regarded as the crown jewel of the Afghan security forces. Mm. But there are very few of them. There are only about 12,000, and they've been overextended. They've been asked to do things they shouldn't be doing. If you have a larger U.S. training mission, maybe you could increase the number of Afghan special forces, and that obviously would not put the Afghan military in a position to defeat the Taliban, but it could make its job a little bit easier. So I think we need to look at modest steps, small steps here, that can come out of this modest troop increase. Now, of course, if nothing seems to be changing over the next few months, in the next year or so, then it's time to reexamine what to do next.
What do you think, Dan?
I agree. I think they do want to expand the special forces. That's something to watch. It's something to watch, just a very basic statistic. You know, is the Taliban losing territory or gaining territory? That's a very key barometer. And then also, I would look very carefully at what the U.S. does or doesn't do when it comes to diplomacy and Afghanistan. Will they really put a big effort into trying to get the Taliban and the Afghan government to the table? Because at different moments, neither side wanted to talk to each other. And it'll be very interesting to see how much energy they put into that. Do they try to bring Pakistan, Russia, Iran into this, or do they just let everything lie and just wait this out? But I would look at what happens on the ground and what happens with diplomacy.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Really appreciate it. Dan DeLuce, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy. Michael Kugelman, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Many thanks.
And he is Asia Program Deputy Director, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.